Is it a vintage device?
No, it's a relatively recent device. I would say, again, this I'll consider this another hint, that probably it came into being about 12, 14 years ago, maybe.
All right, Roger. That shoots down my guess. AC2PL, thanks.
How about some kind of light meter?
Boy.
Yeah, light detector, light meter.
Okay, so basically a photo detector type of thing. No, it wouldn't be a photo detector.
And is organic compound semiconductor material or is not?
Say again?
Is it organic compound semiconductor material?
Well, yeah, I mean, organic is just another term for carbon-based.
So then we have naphthalene, we have unpyrethylene, we have a poly, I'm reading, polyacrylenate, and those are too exotic. I don't know, but good question.
WOT, is there some form of an LED, carbon type LED?
Okay, I'll take that one at a time. Wesley first, if you're going to recite every organic molecule known to mankind, the repeater will go off and on and off and on for about a week or two, or a month or two, or maybe a year. There's a lot of organic compounds. Chris, yes? So Chris, would you like to expand either upon your answer or a comment or what have you?
Well, you know, you kind of gave a hint there. So there's certain forms of diodes, not a rectifier. It just kind of brought me back to the LED.
Okay, but what kind of an LED, and where would you find an LED like that?
I don't know.
Okay, Chris. You are right on the cliff. You are dangling your toes away from it, and all you need is a little teeny shove, I think, and it will be revealed to you. But if anyone wants to take the great strides that Chris has offered this group, and run to the for a touchdown, give it a try.
HD.
Yes, Jim.
Alright, my third swing, maybe it's a miss, but the infrared LED for a remote control device.
Well, no, it is not an infrared LED for a remote control device.
One shot laser diodes?
Well, I guess theoretically you might make one, but that's not really what's being done. It's not for lasers. Lasers wouldn't benefit from the assets of this particular design choice.
Are you thinking of a TV with LEDs? AFB.
Okay, what kind of LEDs would those be?
Well, the liquid crystal was great.
Organic LEDs?
Okay. The first answer was LCD. LCD is not LEDs. LCD is liquid crystal displays. LCDs are the old television technology in a electric potential causes the material to polarize and either block or allow the transmission of the backlighting and the filters to give you a picture. But Ed wins the prize. It's organic light emitting diodes. It's OLEDs. It's those expensive television sets that your brother-in-law or your second cousin keeps telling you that he spent $5,000 for. It's the screen on the iPhone, if you have one of those. It's all over the place.
I refuse wise. I just wondered into it.
When we talk about light-emitting diodes, the green and blue is by indium gallium nitride. The orange and red is by aluminum gallium indium phosphide. And the red is by gallium arsenide, yeah. Nothing more. Oh, there is a yellow. Yellow is gallium phosphide. No. Enter a ship.
Well, that's fine, Wesley, but you're not talking about organic light-emitting diodes. You're now talking about non-organic light-emitting diodes. The technology of organic light-emitting diodes are carbon-based materials that are cheaper to manufacture, cheaper to produce on a large screen. Eventually, the hope of the industry is probably on a technology called micro-LED. Those other types of LEDs, which have their own benefits but are not easily manufactured for the screen density and sizes. So the OLED materials are, it sort of depends on the technology. Very expensive OLEDs use red, green, and blue molecules that emit red, green, and blue. The ones that you can usually buy that are not meant for broadcast standards is a mixture of blue and yellow organic light-emitting diodes. And in proper mixture, they produce a white color, and then you filter them out with red, green, and blue, and sometimes red, green, blue, and clear for white subpixel images. That's LG's old OLED technology. If you've been reading recently, Samsung has introduced a new technology that they call QD LED. Instead of a mixture of blue and yellow, the backlighting is purely blue OLED, and they use something called quantum dots that absorb the blue color and readmit them according to the size of the nano semiconductor particle into red and green. And that's how they break it out. So Samsung is the latest and greatest using quantum dots. But the OLEDs are either blue-yellow in LG or blue in Samsung.
Yeah, actually, OLED is organic material.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to, but a lot of those, some of them are, and I don't know. But it's basically organic light-emitting diodes are called organic light-emitting diodes because they contain carbon. That's the description. There's a field called organic chemistry, which is has a lot of stuff in it that is all about carbon molecules. The only two carbon molecules that are not included in organic chemistry is carbon dioxide and cyanide. Otherwise, if it's got a carbon, it's organic.
Change to STP.
Yes, Chris.
So you touched on something earlier about the diamonds being a really good radiator of heat, or to dissipate the heat really well. I'm wondering if diamonds would make a really good solar panel. Of course, it would be the girl's best friend, a very expensive solar panel, but I would imagine someone has tried that. What do you think?
Well, in the present technology, unless they could figure out a way of doping it and making it a diode, basically solar cells are just kind of diodes in reverse. I guess it's possible. I don't know if there would be any particular benefit. The primary benefit so far for including a diamond substrate is as a means to more efficiently dissipate the waste heat. So where that would probably come in useful if the cost were low enough would be for things like CPUs that generate a great deal of thermal waste heat that has to be efficiently dissipated. Finally, Ed, generic away.
Not tremendous stone quality diamond and industrial diamond material, diamond dust, very inexpensively. There are all kinds of diamond saw blades and the like coming through concrete. Very, very, very tiny diamonds. They're quite inexpensive.
gemstones that come the old-fashioned way, but like, for example, I teach you through deposition, very thin layer of diamond, perhaps to act as a thermal conductor, but unless, now, it's a lot more expensive than the others, but it's nowhere near like we're talking for a gem.
I think I know, Dr. Rui. You're talking about TFT display material. It's organic material.
No, it's not. TFT is just transistors embedded in each pixel. It's an LCD technology. By putting a high-gain transistor at each pixel, you're able to increase the amount of power that you're using to turn the crystal's polarity to your wishes, and it gives you a much more contrasty image than the old-fashioned kind of green background LCDs that didn't have TFT technology. But it's not organic. It's, you know, it's not.
I have a problem with that answer. Isn't that? The basic concept behind the TFT display is a light to create an image on the screen. So light passes through the glass substrate and then organic transistors until it reaches the top layer of the display. So the organic transistor turns on and off in response to the electrical charge of light passing through them. True or false?
Okay, I guess you got me. I don't know if that's inherent or this is just relatively new technology utilizing organics from organic light-emitting diodes. So you might be right. It might be the active ingredient. I tend to doubt CFT's been around for, God knows, 80s? I really sincerely doubt that they were using organic transistors. I think that nowadays modern TFTs are capable of utilizing organic TFTs, but I think this is a relatively new thing.
I have a problem with that too. It's relatively old. The basic design of TFT display was unchanged for more than 20 years, and it was designed from some sub-pixels. There were around as a grid pattern with each sub-pixel connected to the neighbor by wires that forms rows and columns. And to you.
Okay, well, I don't know what to tell you. Like I said before, as far as I'm aware, you know, I am doing a very, very fast Google search, and it doesn't look like the original ones were organic, but missing something. They talk about thin film MOSFETs of germanium monoxide. Last time I checked, the germanium isn't carbon, so I'm not quite sure. Again, it's possible that they've implemented TFT with carbon-based transistors. I unfortunately was not aware of that permutation.
PhD.
Yes.
Yeah, just one more thing. It's 1968. Then it was 1970, then it was 1980. It was only changing resolution. Sanyo was the first one, and to exit.
Okay, Jim, you want to say something?
Roy, compliments. I thought that was an excellent puzzle. You had me firing neurons that have been dormant for quite some time. Well done. If that was your intention, you succeeded in space. Excellent job, thank you. KD2VHD, Jim, over.
Okay, I appreciate it. I just did a quick search for organic field effects transistors, which is what TFTs use, and the earliest date that I could find where it's actually mentioning organic is 2007. But, you know, what can I tell you? I guess partially you were quite right, Wesley. And I did not realize that the field effects transistors also included carbon. They're not really described that way for the most part, although if you look real closely, they'll mention OFETs as organic field effects transistors. But nevertheless, I think it's at least was a useful exercise for discussing television displays and cell phone displays. And I hope everyone enjoyed the little romp.
Captain.
chemist approved.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that in mind, thanks to everyone who played along. I hope you enjoyed yourselves. I did, once again. And time for SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
Okay, AC2GS WS2N. You go to like Target or Best Buy out here anyway. You walk through the store and you see the, they have a couple of them on display, the OLEDs. Side by side, no question about it. The picture is just phenomenal. Fortunately, the price is like six times the price of the other ones. So they got to do something with that price, bring that down. Anyway, this is SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Usually I start off with launches and landings. We had one landing come back, Axiom 1. That was the crew that went up supposedly for 8-day stay on the space station. Wound up collectively 17 days due to weather problems in Florida. So they got an extra few days on board the station. They had a successful landing in the Atlantic Ocean. And all their parachutes open properly. There's four parachutes on the Dragon when it comes down. You know, the Dragon comes down and the trunk separates before they enter the atmosphere. That's the back part of the spacecraft, exposing the heat shield, and the Pika heat shield did its job. And then the drogue chutes come out, and then eventually they pull out four parachutes. The last two Dragons that came back, three came out okay. The fourth one was delayed a little bit. They've been looking into it. They said it's just a normal phenomenon. But I don't know about that. Anyway, this one, they all opened up perfectly without doing any changes, count changes to the system. So I hope they get their act together and, you know, future flights will go the same way. Drop it. Okay. On another topic, the Space Launch System, that's NASA's big Moon Mega Rocket. That's what some of the gases are calling it now, the Moon Mega Rocket. The SLS Space Launch System, which consists of, right now it's a 322-tall rocket. You know, it's got the liquid oxygen tank. On the bottom you have four engines. They're the same engines that the shuttle used to use. The shuttle used to use three RS-25 engines, and these are the same engines that will, you know, produce, each one is going to produce 500,000 pounds of thrust, and between that and the side boosters, you're going to wind up with 8.2 million pounds of thrust, which is more than the Saturn V. Saturn V was 7.5. You know, we've yet to see this thing fly yet. They had it out at Launch Complex 39B, that's where we'll launch from, for about a month. They wanted to do what they call a wet dress rehearsal, loaded up with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, you know, both first stage and second stage, and go through all the procedures, bring it down to 10 seconds before launch, shut everything down, and then the plan was to bring it back to the vehicle assembled, but the lignin solar. Go through all the data, and then in another month it was launch. But they had some problems that liquid helium check valve, it apparently had to be changed. That was an operating problem. And apparently a hydrogen leak in one of the fill lines. They went through like 90% of the tests. They didn't complete it, but they're now. Well, they've already brought it back to the vehicle assembly building, put it onto the transport crawler, and off it goes. I think it's over 10-mile ride, over 10-hour ride, 4.5 miles to get back to vehicle assembly building. And they had to, you know, work out those couple of issues, and then now they say within a couple of months this thing should land, launch. They'll bring it back into. Launch Complex 39B, and it'll probably go through another wet rehearsal. At that point, if everything is okay, they'll go for launch, and that's the one that's not going to be manned this time. I mean, it could be. Got the Orion
spacecraft on top that, you know, can handle four people to go all the way to the moon and back. But right now it's going to be unmanned because it's never flown before. They will send it to the moon. It will orbit the moon, and then eventually deorbit the moon and come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. If that goes well, the next flight, Artemis, this will be Artemis 1. Artemis 2 will have a crew, and they'll duplicate that. They'll go into orbit. They won't land on the moon. They'll come back. And then Artemis 3 is one that would be scheduled to land on the moon. So Artemis 3 is probably, you know, 2.5 years away. We'll see. Roughly 1 year, a little less than 1 year, but roughly 1 year for every launch, for the space launch system. Their prediction. Anyway, any questions before I go on? I have a few things to go down the list here. Any comments? Okay, there was another launch, you know, the Axiom. That was a private mission with four people that went up there for 17 days that came back. That's a private mission. They both paid roughly $55 million each to take that trip on the Dragon crew vehicle. Dragon is also used by NASA. So NASA had a crew of four go up to the space station. Talked about that before. And successfully went up Wednesday. And then the next day, one day later, they docked with the space station. They have two hams on board, Lindgren and Samantha Crisparetti. Crisparetti comes out of Italy. And I'm not sure she has an Italian call. Not that it matters. When they on station, they use ISS call. Like Kayla Barron, she was up there. She's up there for a couple of months now. She just made a contact with an Ohio school, an Aries contact. So her call is KI5LAL. So it just keeps going on and on. That program with the Aries is still operating for a couple of decades now. And they actually have planned on especially having ham contact astronauts when they were orbiting the moon. Again, that's quite a few years out, but it's on the Aries drawing board to do that. Drop it. Okay, that crew will stay on board for 6 months. We have a steady crew of seven on board. Three Russians up there now. So, you generally have a crew of seven. Sometimes, you have one crew going up, and they'll have an overlap for a couple of days, sometimes a week. So you might have, 11 people on board. But in general, nowadays, seven people, usually four from NASA, from a Dragon spacecraft, which handles four, and there's always three for a Soyuz spacecraft from Russia. And you always have these spacecraft permanently attached to the space station until they leave. They work as lifeboats too, in case there's a fire or a problem. They all have a seat. The flight rules are, however many people you have on station, you have to have as many seats to go home with in case there's a problem. Any comments? Repeater was starting to go down. That's my signal. Roy, are you there?
Yeah, there's about 20% noise, but you're completely understandable.
Okay. Feel a little bit better. Just rotated my beam a little bit, Roy.
Yeah, it sounds better now.
Understood, I needed that. My QTH, by the way, everybody, is in Ron Kockmar, so I have my beam pointing to Glen Oaks. I could go, the other way, but sometimes there's less problems here. Sometimes the Selden repeater acts up a little bit. But as long as this is okay, I won't turn my beam to Selden. I'll just leave it on Glen Oaks. Okay, there's a helicopter flying around on Mars. Brought up by the Perseverance 2020 rover, and last February 18th, the year before, so been up there for 14 months now. One of the things that
Perseverance did was leave off this helicopter, and they were hoping to get like 5 flights out of it, you know. Anything over 2 or 3, they would have considered a success. So the plan was get the 5 flights and then just drop it, just leave it there, and the rover will ride around on it on its own for many, many years to come. Since the helicopter, Ingenuity is the name of it, is working so good, they keep flying it over and over and over. Over all these months, it has now flown 26 times and successfully. And, you know, it flies roughly 2 minutes each time. Sometimes it'll, you know, go straight and they'll make a dog leg and go one way or another. It comes down and finds its own landing spot. It has a computer on board where and a camera that looks straight down. It determines if there's any boulders or big craters in the way that might foul up a landing. And it makes that its own determination. One good spot gets a probably, you know, it's off the ground. And then it actually shuts the blades down. It kind of just drops. And they have enough spring in the legs where they don't have any kind of problem. It's not powered all the way down. Otherwise, if it hit the ground, it was still powered, it might, you know, act up and flip the whole thing up, you know, onto its side. But it actually just cuts the power. They drop straight down. You can see videos of that. But it's doing so well that started to use it for reconnaissance for the Perseverance rover. So it'll go out ahead of it, look around. For scientific investigations, looking at geology. You know, it has two cameras, one for landing, black and white. Then it's got a camera that sticks out on the side and is able to pictures. And that's a regular color camera. It's taken pictures of Perseverance on the surface of Mars before. But this last picture it took, they knew where the parachute was and the back shell was. That parachute in the back shell comes off, separates from the rover on the way down. So when Perseverance is coming through the atmosphere, they call that EDL, entry, descent, and landing. During EDL, you know, it comes through, it's got a... It separates from the cruise stage, then it starts to entering the atmosphere. You have the heat shield comes through at roughly 13,000 miles an hour, so the shield protects the rover on the way down. And then eventually, when it gets a little bit lower, the top part of the whole system, called the aero shell or the back shell on top. The parachute that pops out of that big 70-foot diameter parachute. And that, first it was a drogue chute and then a parachute. And that eventually slows it down to the point where, below sound. And it gets to the point where the rover will eventually be able to land on a surface with its wheel down. So the wheel separates and that exposes the bottom. The bottom of the rover can see the ground with radar and all. Tells the computer, okay, I'm getting close to the ground. Let's get rid of the back shell and the parachute. Does that back shoot? Parachute and the back shell separate, and then they fly away. And they eventually land somewhere on the surface of Mars. And then tipping down, they have the sky crane system. This is the series of 8 jets, rockets. Ignite and then slows down until eventually the wheels touch the surface, and then that piece separates from the rover and takes off and flies, you know, a couple of kilometers away. But anyway, the parachute and that back shell, they want to take a picture of it because they're going in that direction where it was, and sure enough, Ingenuity, this little helicopter, took a nice picture of it. Put it onto his website. You can see what that looks like. Or it's probably on a lot of space websites. It's a pretty popular thing. Anyway, Roy has them on his. Sent it over to him. And you can see the back shell. It's pretty much intact. It's a couple of pieces laying all over. You can see the parachute still laying there. And as an engineering point, takes the picture. information gets sent back to NASA. Engineers look at it, and they can better design different craft. You know, they know how well it held up. They make it better in the future. Anyway, this is after 26 flights now. They were hoping to get 5. They're up to 26, and the thing is still going strong. It's got this 4-foot, 2-4-foot long blades that spin one. You know, you've got the cube that weighs, you know, roughly three kilograms. Top part of it is also very light. The whole thing weighs just four kilograms. I think it's around four and a half pounds or something like that. It's less than probably 2.5 kilograms. 4-pound thing. This helicopter's been flying for years now. Over, well, not years, but probably a year. And you know, very successful for more flights in the future. It keeps going and going. It's got natural lithium ion batteries on board. And above the blades, it has a solar panel. So when it's sitting there for hours on end, it's charging and charging. Each time it takes off, it's got a full charge. And it says, well, you know, the last flight was roughly 2 minutes long, and able to tilt it, and it goes like the devil. Last flight was said, a little over 1,000 feet, you know, like the length of 3 football fields. Now it landed. So anyway, that's the report on Ingenuity. Any questions or comments? WS. And there was another launch the other day, another Starliner launch. SpaceX keeps launching these things, one right after the other. I think it's 43 launches so far dedicated just to put the Starlink broadband system into space over the last couple of years. Now they have over 2,000 active satellites, and they want ongoing and going. They like over 4,000 for a complete system. Got a request in to the government to allow us to put 40,000 of these satellites up into space. So, I don't know. I think it's 17th launch of, collectively, different missions, mostly Starlink missions, just for this year. I think it's 6 or 7 flights for April alone. So reusability is working out. He keeps reflying these boosters over and over again. Naturally, he can't refly the second stage orbit eventually and burn up. It does save the fairings, those big half fairings, from, you know, like 5 meters in diameter and 40 feet tall. And they can come down into 2 halves, parachutes and all, ejectors on it. Originally, he was trying to catch them in a net that was attached to boats. He did that a couple of times, but that became much too difficult. He kept missing. Changed different things of where the vents are, different things where we're at. It can land in the water, and one side pretty much up that does have the electronics on it. Makes it where it no longer gets wet. And he reused bearings that actually made it to Switzerland. The ship moment. There. Roughly $6 million a piece. So he saves all kinds of money just by recovering these things. Take the boat out, pull them out of the ocean. It's a lot cheaper than paying $6 to $7 million, another set of fairings every time you have to have a flight. Plus, it helps with his manifest. He's got, every other week he wants to do another flight. So, I don't think Switzerland can produce the fairings fast enough. So he needs to reuse these things. But it's really bringing space flight cheaper, and of course a good thing, and as long as he doesn't compromise safety, and I'm all for it. Any questions? WS2N. Okay, this other topic here that I have is a little strange. It's called the MMS, Magnetic Reconnection System. So satellites, anyway, that launched around 7 years ago. And it was four satellites orbiting Earth, very high altitude, and then low perigee. Comes down to around 1,000 miles above the surface. Then it goes all the way out to 100,000 miles, out, sometimes halfway to the moon, and then it comes back again, back down to around 1,000 miles below the Earth. You know, it's very highly elliptical flight. The idea is to pick up something called magnetic reconnection. I'm trying to study this thing for the last 50 years. Apparently, they have some kind of a breakthrough. They've managed to figure out how this works. As you have their solar flare, plasma flies through space, plasma being electrons separated from the protons. When it's in a plasma state, it's highly affected by magnetic fields in that fourth state of matter. When you get the Earth, sure enough, magnetic fields from Earth picked up on it, and it flies around and reconnects on the other side of the Earth, and also comes back again and also reconnects on the front. So these four satellites have been flying together, you know, relatively close, you know, within a couple of miles of each other, in more or less the shape of a pyramid. They have four of these things, and they can tell, you know, when this magnetic reconnection that occurs, satellites are in the right spot. Scientists are able to pick up on this information, try to figure it out. I'll have to read more about it, but apparently they're very happy with their theory so far, and they're going to continue on using the MMS satellites. Those things were launched, like I said, 7 years ago by an Atlas V rocket. Turns out it was very successful. I remember when that went up. We talked about that on the net years ago. No? Okay. Any other comments, questions? Leaving time for Echo Link. I don't hear anything. Anyway, there's another program that NASA's been running for quite a few years now, called SOFIA. SOFIA is a telescope that they put on 747. Big telescope. I mean, it's like 8-foot diameter, you know, the lens. So it's very similar to actually a Hubble Space Telescope. And it can see an infrared as well as visual. It sticks out of the side of the 747. The name of the thing is called the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, SOFIA. And apparently they think that it's too cost effective to keep this operating. So they're going to shut this down this September. You know, just close the whole program down. So it feel, well, we got the James Webb Space Telescope to look in the infrared. We don't need this thing anymore. They think the science that they're getting out of it isn't really worth it. Well, it's the same object that found that there was water molecules, you know, embedded in the regolith of the moon. It looked at the moon and different, you know, the surface, not just the south pole or north pole or inside a crater, just the surface itself. And it made discoveries there. It helped, also helped New Horizons when it was going to Pluto to determine different information about what that team needed to know when it got to Pluto. They're gonna pack this thing up. Not gonna fly anymore. They said it's got like 1,000 hours of operating time. It's just not worth it to do it anymore. So I think Sophia is gonna go bye bye. So we'll see. You never know. They tried to get rid of it a couple of years ago. Then it made a comeback. And NASA works with the German Space Agency with this project. So they're also invested in it. DLR, DLR is the agency that, you know, the civil agency in Germany, similar to NASA. So it's a $3 billion program that planned on using it for 20 years. I think they got, 8 years or something out of it, less than that. I don't know. I don't know if they should have abandoned it. I think it's good. It was a good project. You know, with all the money they throw around, I think they could have kept it going. But at the end, you know, things come to an end. Any comments or questions, put in that WS2S. Okay, there's one other topic I really wanted to talk about is a spacecraft called Tenacity. That's the name they gave it, Tenacity. Dream Chaser spacecraft, which has been on the
drawing boards. I remember 2014, they flew this thing. At that time, it was going to be strictly for crew to eventually fly to different space stations. And as the time went on, NASA decides, well, we'll pick two companies to fly to the space station. They picked SpaceX. Worked out okay. They flew up and as well as cargo flights to the space station. And then they also picked Starliner. Starliner is being built by Boeing. That's launched on a Atlas V rocket by ULA. ULA is a consortium of two companies, Boeing and Lockheed. They've been launching rockets in NASA since, 1990? In this case, the Atlas V rocket. They would put this thing on. And it's got wings on it, so it's a mini shuttle. It would be about 25% of the size of the shuttle. But it would be able to carry about the same amount of people. Roughly seven people would fit on this thing. When NASA picked the two companies, Boeing and SpaceX, for crew flight, that knocked Dream Chaser out. Dream Chaser, the company that makes this is Sierra Nevada, located in Colorado. Said, okay, well, we're going to keep going with this. We're just going to make it a cargo version. They did. They just scrapped the idea temporarily for a crew, and they developed this as a cargo vehicle. Now, as time went on, the amount of flights that were being done by Cygnus, that's the Antares flight, space station for cargo, or cargo flights by SpaceX with a cargo Dragon vehicle. NASA said, well, we're going to need more cargo, for the base station and eventually others. We're going to need another company. So the next time they contract out, sure, they gave Cygnus more contract, which was now Northrop Grumman, that company, and also SpaceX. They also chose now Dream Chaser for cargo. So now over the last couple of years, they're really developing this. And now they said it's almost completely done. They got wings on it now. What it amounts to is they just got to finish with the piles that they're going to install on thermal protection system. Once that's done, they expect this thing maybe to be able to fly next year. Fly not on an Atlas V rocket, which is the original plan. So the years have gone by. The Atlas V is due to be replaced by the Vulcan rocket, which is now being made by Boeing and Lockheed Martin, United Launch Alliance. That's in full swing, and in fact, their first flight might be at the end of this year, first Vulcan flight. And then soon after that, probably next year, they plan on putting this thing on the top of that to launch to the space station for a test. Bring cargo up, and they'll bring a lot of cargo, maybe 12,000 pounds, like 6 tons of stuff up to the space station once it does fly on Vulcan. Top of the spacecraft will be, the spacecraft will be enclosed by fairing, similar to the fairings like I was talking about before that encloses the spacecraft or payload on the top of any rocket. Thing will be enclosed, but enclose it in that, it's only so big. You have to fold the wings, so they developed a lot of got together. They decided that we're going to fold the back wings on the Dream Chaser. So they've done that. So after launch, if the thing goes up next year, Vulcan go up. It's going to have a couple of solid boosters also attached to it. The boosters will fall off. The first stage will fall off. The second stage will have two RL liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket on top called Centaur. I'll have two, but they've flown like 400 of these things over the years on different vehicles. This one's going to contain two engines, usually just one. And that will push Dream Chaser to orbit and dock with the space station.
after that, it's not going to be able to fly back to Earth and actually land on almost any runway. Of course, at the beginning, they'll probably just bring it back to Kennedy Space Center on that 3-mile-long runway. But they named it. It's called Tenacity, and if I was to see that, seen that much. Now, I just read recently that Sierra Nevada now developing same vehicle, except again for human spaceflight. So, in the future, they hope to get a contract from NASA or maybe somebody else, maybe one of the private space stations that are being planned, like Orbital Reef. Orbital Reef is a big space station that will eventually be put into space actually by Amazon. And also, it's a deal between Amazon and Sierra Nevada investing in the space station as well. So, 5 months is on, and things change sometimes quickly, but sometimes slowly. But this, for this company, it's been slow, but kept at it, and I think they're going to be very successful in the long run with Dream Chaser. Okay, looking at the time, I'm bringing this session to close. We'll turn it back to Roy. Tomorrow's Monday night, so well, I want to check into the Linemark Clubnet, Club InfoNet that comes on at 8:30 on these repeaters. Find out what the club is doing. That's always good. They usually follow that with Newsline as well. But for now, I'm turning this back to Roy, ACBS WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net, and thank you for all that you do in the club. Once again, I want to thank everyone. Just as a little bit of a footnote, I was looking through organic thin film transistors, and from anything that I could read, they're all research-oriented. They don't have the refresh rate necessary for screens. They're being thought of for flexible screens, but they're in general use as much as buckyballs and graphene are. So that kind of disqualifies that answer. Anyway, once again, want to thank everyone that participated tonight. I know I enjoyed myself. I hope you did. I hope you come back next Sunday when we'll do it all over again. And want to remind people, if you need to reach me via email, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Need to contact Paul. His is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My link page has a lot of interesting articles. There's a YouTube from Derek Mueller of Veritasium where he discusses in even more detail how electric fields are the mean vaying energy to a load. If you want to look at it and talk about it next TechNet, I'm more than happy. So the link page is roy.ac2gs.com, and the audio stream is technet.ac2gs.com. If you want to listen to Glen Oaks and you don't have a radio, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and you'll hear. Mike, KC2NJI, of course, has amateurradio.tv, a great archive of technical net that goes far back to September of 2006. Let me drop for a second. Okay. Well, once again, we come to an end of another TechNet. As Dick, K2RIW, would often end the technical net, so be kind to each other. Be good to each other. Friends, family, even enemies. We're all in this together. So be safe, be well, and please come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS calling it the end of this particular technical net, and I am clear.
is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL.
W2VL. W2VL.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the
W2. W2.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2.
W2.
W2. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Kilo.
W2.
Here is WB2 EAV listening.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2.
And here we go. Patriot KNB, WB2Z.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W.
WB2ZSA.
KB2TXQ is listening.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W.
WB2ZSA.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is W2. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W.
KB2TXQ listening.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W.
Turn, see what you can do to make give me more volume.
KD2ZFD, thank you for the advice.
Okay, Roger, this is KB2TXQ. This is you are KD2ZFG, is that correct?
KD2ZFD.
Okay, Roger, KD2ZFD. Looks like you're a brand new ham. I just got your license very recently.
I did, and you're my first contact.
Hey, that's great, that's great. It's nice to be the first contact. I just got my license. Well, I was an old novice back in the day, and I just re-got my technician license. And my old call sign was KD2ZDJ, and so we were very close. But I just got my vanity call sign back, so that's why I'm KB2TXQ.
KB2ZXQ, correct?
Yeah, KB2 Tango X-ray Quebec.
Well, I'm over in East Meadow. What's your location?
Yeah, I'm in Glendale, Queens, and I'm working off a little Slim Jim on my window on the second floor. It's an indoor antenna, but this repeater is very good. It's very active, and I really can connect with it, and I get good sound, and everybody seems to hear me pretty well. Although I'm going to be putting an outdoor antenna up probably within the next 2 weeks, the J-pole.
Yeah, thank you. I just built a Slim Jim myself. It's supposedly a J-pole Slim Jim.
Okay, very good. I was too cheap. I guess I didn't want to spend the time, so I went out and bought one for $25, and it seems to be working really well. Everybody says I got good sound, and they hear me well. So that's pretty good. But I do want to see if I can get some more distant repeaters. If I get my outdoor antenna up on the roof, the J-pole, hopefully I get some more distant repeaters, although guys tell me that this is the most active repeater by far in the area.
Yeah, I think so. There's a bunch of repeaters near me. I've got a list from repeater book, and this one seems the most active, but there's several, half a dozen more 2 miles from me.
K2PJD.
Go ahead, last caller.
Yeah, what's up, guys? Just heard the queue, so I figured I'd jump in real quick. I grew up in Glendale, Queens.